from the Hof van Lieren in Antwerp, and today we invited Professor in Behavior and Society, Caroline de Klerk. We are Charlotte and Celine. You are listening to Profcast. Welcome, Professor de Klerk, and thank you for being here. For those that don't know you, you've studied biology, ecology, and evolution before becoming a professor in behavioral sciences and social psychology. In what way do you implement that background in your classes and research? And why is it important to study behavior as a business and as an economics student?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. I'm happy to be here. And yes, I do implement biology, ecology, and evolution a lot in the classes I teach. And to me, these topics are very important. In fact, I think they're important to any scholar who wants to understand human nature. It's all about making decisions. As humans, we make decisions all the time, whether we are a business manager, an economist, a parent, an architect, an athlete, or even a drug addict. We make decisions and they have small or large consequences. And what I want to show in my lectures is that understanding how we make these decisions is truly interdisciplinary. So decisions cannot be captured simply by economic utility functions. The take-home message is a complexity and there are many factors that come into play.
It's a very extensive field. Eh? It covers everything basically from the starting point of evolution up until now, it seems. Well, and of course, you mentioned it already, but you cover a lot of interdisciplinary fields such as neuroeconomics, hormones, and the brain. If you look back on your career so far, what has been some of the most striking research that you have come across?
Well, for me, I'm fascinated by the research on trust. Trust is the precursor of cooperation, and it's what makes us truly human. And I like to refer to Yuval Harari here, whose popular books I really like to read. He compares our trading finances with monkeys and says, well, there's no monkey that will trade a banana for a piece of paper, which then we would call money, and that piece of paper would be worth two bananas in the future, or an apple if you trade it with some other monkey. So our trust goes much, much farther than monkeys, and we have really financial trading institutions. But before telling you about the research with trust, I want to define trust. I want to emphasize that trust is not the same as risk. Trust has two components. It has a belief component, the cognitive component, in which we express the trust is the expressing the probability that we think our trusting act will be repaid. So we expect some sort of gain out of the trusting act. And that's the same as risk. It's like the probability that you would win a lottery. But in addition, trust has a betrayal aversion, an anticipation of how pissed you will be if your trust is not repaid. It's very emotional. So if you put money in a vending machine and the vending machine doesn't give you your Coke or your candy bar, then, well, you're disappointed, but you're not really averse to that. You know that vending machines sometimes break down and there's no intention with that. But if your friend doesn't repay a loan or borrows your car and takes off with it, or even worse, walks off with your girlfriend, then you're really pissed. And it's this betrayal and aversion that makes trust so important and so interesting to me.
Okay, but yeah, and speaking of trust, it's quite a difficult concept in a sense. How do you measure it in an academic context?
That's a good question. Economists they've developed a really fun game to measure trust, and it's one of these economic games that's been played thousands of times, and there's a lot of paper published it, and we can play it right here. So it's called the investment game or trust game. And imagine that you, Celine, and Charlotte, that you're two strangers. You don't know each other. You're sitting in separate rooms. And I'm giving both of you 10 euros. And so you start off equal. And there's no reason to share anything. You don't know each other. And you are, Charlotte, the bank or the investor or the trustor. And you can give or invest, transfer any part of your 10 euros to Celine, and I triple that amount. Okay, so whatever you lose, you give to Celine, it will be tripled. And then Celine has, of course, a lot more money, and you can give a part back. You can repay that trust and give it back to Charlotte. So how much would you invest? Oh. 10 euros means if you invest all of it, you have zero. It means that Celine has 40, 10 that she already had, and 30. And then you can walk off with it. Or you can repay the trust.
It's a good question. So I think personally, I would give it all away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, you know her.
Yes, but I think even if I didn't.
If you didn't.
Trusting in strangers is a concept I do quite like. But of course, we're talking about 10 euros.
Okay. What would you do?
I'm not that good a person as Celine. And I don't have that much trust in strangers. So I would keep a small amount to myself. Does that make me a bad human?
No, not at all. There's a lot of variation. Typically, people do not trust everything. So a lot of people do entrust the entire amount, but some people keep a little bit to themselves. Some keep all of it to themselves. There's a lot of variation in here. Most people repay. There's very few people that don't repay anything, but most people keep also a little bit more for themselves than they repay. So
okay, thank God.
So you have everything in there. Huh? So there's reason to be a little bit wary, because you won't always win and you might lose big time. So in general, I think people are trustworthy. Otherwise, we wouldn't have financial institutions. We wouldn't be where we are in this cooperative society. But, you know, we're also self-interested. So now back to the research that we've done. So there is betrayal aversion, and some people have more of it than others. It's a real preference. Some people feel much anxiety to trust and others don't. We've seen it here already with only two people. And there's a leading hypothesis that the hormone oxytocin would increase trust. And oxytocin is the hormone that's released during breastfeeding, and it forges bonds to the mother and with the mother and child. It's also released in men, like fathers playing with their children. And so it's a hormone that we know from animal research that is really important in forming these affiliative bonds between conspecifics. So in 2005, a paper came out that if you administer a spray of oxytocin to humans and have them play this trust game, that compared to a placebo, they trust more. And they don't become more risk-taking or risk-seeking because they don't change their behavior in lotteries. But in this trust game, they start trusting more than they would have if they had taken a placebo. And of course, if you publish a finding like that, it will be contested, and it was heavily contested. And my colleague Christophe Bourne and myself and one of the initial authors of the paper, who happened to receive an honorary doctorate here at our university, so we met and we talked about this trust and trust game, and we decided to set up a real big replication study in Antwerp and also in Magdeburg in Germany. So in total, we tested 800 participants. And we had two different settings, one in which the trust game was played completely private in cubicles, and one in which people met before they played the game. So there was a little bit of social contact, thinking, well, oxytocin might work a little bit different in two contexts. Well, what did we find?
I'm very curious.
Yeah, me too.
But we didn't replicate the study. So oxytocin had no effects in general on everybody. So we could not say oxytocin increases trust in humans, like the paper had claimed. But then we did additional analyses. We had measured people's individual disposition to trust. Like here we saw it already, one person trusts really easily, no anxiety. You feel more anxiety to trust. So we measured this in advance, just knowing that there are individual differences. What are people's individual inclinations to trust? And then we did see that oxytocin did increase trust for those people who were low in trust. So people that have more anxiety to trust, and when they're only also when they were sitting in the cubicles, when they're in the calm environment, not aroused by other people, then oxytocin did really, compared to placebo, increase their trusting behavior in that game.
It's so interesting to find that one hormone can impact such a it almost seems like we're not fully in control of our decisions sometimes.
it only worked for some people in certain situations and not always. So it works sometimes and for some people. But yes, that goes back to what I want to teach in my classes, that decision making is complex and oxytocin does in all likelihood play a role. We know this very well from cause and effect studies in animals, but it's more complex than that. So we need to also take these individual differences in account and the situation and how the situation is interpreted.
Yeah, I might be mistaken, but I actually always thought oxytocin was the happiness hormone.
Well, that's what the media has made of it. And the latest thoughts on oxytocin is that it's really a hormone that helps to create homeostasis or allostasis, meaning a constant environment across different situations. So oxytocin is released under stress. For example, during childbirth, childbirth is initiated by oxytocin. The physical stress of breastfeeding releases oxytocin. So it's the stress that causes the release of oxytocin, but then oxytocin is also the remedy to remove the stress by forming these affiliative bonds.
Okay, well, I've been brainwashed by the media then.
The media has made it like, don't buy oxytocin, okay? Don't buy it and self-administer it. The effect would be just tiny, so.
I think we've all heard about neuroscience and we've talked about it, but what are neuroeconomics? And how does one conduct research in that field?
Well, neuroeconomics combines studies on decision-making with neuroimaging techniques. And it's to economics what a very similar field is in medicine called decision neuroscience. Decision neuroscience is a subfield of psychiatry where they study the brain and what differs in the brain of people that are making decisions that are unhealthy, like smoking or addictions, or they try to explain why it's so difficult to stick to a diet, for example. And in neuroeconomics, the questions are a little bit different. It's why we deviate from rationality, why we trust, why we cooperate or defect, what the motives are for cooperation and defection, or why we would, for example, choose a small reward now versus a large reward later. All these would be interesting topics in economics. And the aim of neuroeconomics is to visualize how these decisions are made in the brain. Often they use functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. And fMRI differs from an MRI scan. An MRI scan is a still image that we create of the brain by looking at the density of different tissues in the brain. But fMRI actually visualizes the blood flow through the brain, and especially the identifies the regions where blood is oxygenated and blood is deoxygenated. So where there's a lot of blood flow in the brain and you find a lot of deoxygenated blood, that's where a region that would be very metabolically active. So a neuroeconomic experiment could be to look at trust and what happens to the brain when people are making trusting decisions versus non-trusting decisions. And then a person is in the scanner playing the trust game that we just did, and the blood flow is measured in real time. So you know exactly at what point in time, what stimulus you see or what decision you make, and you can correlate that to the brain activity at that time.
Yeah, I'm curious, how did you get into this field? Because, I mean, neuroeconomics for us initially was hard to imagine what it could be, and I can imagine it's also not the most obvious choice starting your career. So yeah, how did you get into that field?
Well, very early on, when I came to the University of Antwerp, we had a professor, Bert de Brabander, and he and my colleague Christophe Bonne, with whom I'm still working together, I was his postdoc, and we had he really loved biology, and he was already interdisciplinary avant la lettre. And he had this really crazy idea at that time of, let's take brain scans and look at decision-making and what happens to the brain. And so he initiated a contact. I'm talking now 15 years ago, but he initiated a contact with the university hospital and the radiology department there. And then we did our first experiment 15 years ago. at the university hospital. We've also played trust games or variations of in the scanner.
And so the decision making is that because we all have heard about nudging, so that in the supermarket the most selling products are on eye height, and that has to do with the decision making of the consumers, or how does the research that you do impact us in our daily life?
Yes, because there is actually a subfield in neuroeconomics that's called neuromarketing, and neuromarketing investigates exactly what you're saying right now. They're interested in, well, what triggers one person to choose one product over another? And it could be emotional or it could be cognitive. There's advertisement techniques that rely definitely on giving people a lot of information so they can make reasoned decisions, like when you buy a computer. But if you want to sell a candy bar, you probably don't want people to know all the ingredients that are in it. So you want to trigger emotional regions of the brain. And not that neuromarketing wants to manipulate people, but they're interested in how do people make decisions. And so with this fMRI technique, you can visualize what regions of the brain are active depending on what product is being chosen. And you can also see how much emotion is involved, because there is regions of the brain like the amygdala or the insula that we know are emotion related, or the how much value we attach to something, that would be another region of the brain. And you can also see what reasoning capacities are necessary to make a decision. So that would be really interested in neuromarketing or in nudging. When you want to nudge someone, you want to bypass all this deliberative reasoning, and you want to really focus on quick decisions, on heuristics, and you can identify these in the brain with these scans.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, and as well, because it's something that if you think about it, there's so many choices on a daily basis we make that we don't really deliberately think about. So, that's probably a good thing as well. Like if we have to think about everything.
No, we don't think so.
But it's good that you're doing the research and finding that out for us. Now, coming a little bit back to your career, we heard that you lived in the US for 20 years. We were curious, what did you do there exactly? And in general, how important do you think international experiences are in an academic career?
Well, first, let me say that for me, it was living in the United States was not an international experience, because I consider myself bicultural. I have both nationalities. I was born in the United States, in Texas, actually, although I do not have a Texan accent. But I grew up in Belgium and I went to school here, into high school, and I returned to the United States when I was 18 to go to college. I went to UC Davis. It's also where I obtained my PhD. And then I lived in Portland, where I taught biology at Portland State University. I think for me, the highlights was living in Bodega Bay for 3 years. It's where I actually did my PhD. And I don't know if you've heard of Bodega Bay. It's where the movie The Birds of Alfred Hitchcock was filmed. Mm-hmm. If you've seen it, it's desolate. There's nothing there. So it's a perfect place to do a PhD. I treasure the fact that I have these two nationalities, and I try to go back as much as I can. As far as international experience, I think, given that I like so much having both views, I think international experiences can be really great, provided that they're intense enough that you really feel that you fit in, that you're one of them, and vice versa, that they that you've become like them. And that doesn't require staying there, but maybe learning the language could also be an international experience, because it forces you to think of concepts in multiple ways. There are multiple ways to say the same thing in different languages. And I can't help but think that helps us to have an open mind and to remain flexible when we have to make decisions. Yeah.
Uh, You also wrote two books, one with the title Who is the Homo Sapiens? And the other, The Compassionate Egoist. One was written for the course Behavior and Society, while the other was a scientific publication. What are those two books about, and which one did you prefer to write?
Interesting. I really enjoyed writing both of them, but they were very different challenges. Because the audience for the Homo Sapiens is a general audience. It's mostly students and anyone who would be interested in human behavior. And in that book, it's chapter by chapter, each chapter describes one of our particularly human capacities like cognition, emotions, consciousness, learning processes, and then finally our sociality and how we behave in groups. And in that last chapters, in how we behave in groups, I really emphasize how we solve social dilemmas. And social dilemmas, I think, is one of the great challenge of society today. It's any situation that we're in which we have a conflict between our own self-interest, what's good for me, and the collective good interest. And I think that all major problems that we're facing today, like climate change, traffic jams, recycling or not, what to do with nuclear waste, are all social dilemmas. Even democracy is a social dilemma in the sense that to sustain democracy, you need sufficient people that are interested in putting effort in it. But it's easier to let the other people study politics and follow the news and vote than to contribute yourself. But the problem is if everybody thinks that way, if too many people choose for the self-interested option, then whatever collective good there might come off will disappear. And in The Compassionate Egoist, I go deeper into how people solve social dilemmas, and especially how our brain is wired to solve social dilemmas. It's about neuroeconomics, and it's a little more technical.
Okay, and talking about The Compassionate Egoist, what is that? Because I don't associate compassion with an egoistic person.
Well, a compassionate egoist is exactly what we all are. We are both. And the premise of the book and of how we solve social dilemmas, why it's a problem for us and why we're all compassionate egoists, is because we're all driven by many motives. And sometimes these motives conflict. For one, we all have to have a self-interest motive. And we need to prioritize ourselves in order to survive. It's a survival instinct, and people will kill if they're threatened out of self-defense. That's the plot of movies and books. But a self-interested egoist is not really well-liked in groups. Being part of the group is also really important for us, because if we're excluded from the group, that's like a great pain, and we won't survive on our own. Children needs are really dependent of their parents for a long time. So, and even in our society, if you're a loner, you have a lot of problems. So we depend on groups. So we need a lot of behaviors to fit in with the group. And that's why we have compassion, why we empathize, why we're altruistic and we help people. So we're constantly balancing these two motives, the self-interest motive and the need to belong. And that makes us the most paradoxical species on Earth. We are extremely cooperative. We've invented technology, and with this technology, we've built houses with central heating. We have extended our life expectancy. We've built space stations. We've even sent Teslas into outer space. But at the same time, while we're so cooperative, we're also extremely destructive. We're the only species that goes to war with our own conspecifics, that declares war to conspecifics, that has genocides. We've provoked genocides. We've destroyed the bulk of the rainforests, and we've filled the oceans with plastics and the earth with nuclear waste. And so the book, The Compassionate Egoist, is not how to fix that. I wish it were, but it's how our brain is wired to make us that way. We're just that way. And it's my hope that by bringing these conflicting motives into awareness and to realizing more of how our brain makes us and steers us in one direction or another, that that's a necessary first step in solving these problems that we have created in the first place.
So now we know why I don't give back all the money to Celine and keep a small amount to myself. It's because I'm a compassionate egoist.
Exactly. And why, for the same reason why Celine invested everything, because she's also that way.
Yeah. It's. I think we know ourselves a lot better after this conversation. Yeah. So, but maybe one final question. What can we expect in the future? Will there be a third book?
Definitely.
The next Yuval Harari.
Who knows? Not that ambitious, but let's hope. Yeah.
This was Profcast with Caroline de Klerk. Thank you for listening. Do you want to hear more? Then be sure to visit our website www.uentrepreneur.be-profcast.